Safety Subcommittee for the purpose of hearing several Administration of Justice presentations. Let the record show that we are beginning without a quorum, and I'll make note when a quorum has arrived. Members, Representative Hanna, good afternoon. Representative Wisner, good afternoon to you. I trust you both had restful weekends.
Very nice. Thank you.
Great. Just a note about the agenda that you have in front of you. Craig Prenz, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission, is going to be testifying in the Judiciary Committee this afternoon, and so we're going to move him over to next week. And then when he is with us, he will also provide an overview of the sentencing guidelines.
Thank you. Do we get a copy like the amends?
You should receive a copy of the sentencing guidelines grid in your Good. In your offices.
You want one right now?
No, sir.
Okay.
I'm not going to sentence anyone right now.
And as you see, we have several partners with us this afternoon, and we're glad to see them back. I'd like to bring up first panel, Bob Jester, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority, along with Max Williams, Director of the Department of Corrections. And they will be followed by Peter Roseanne, Director of the Defense Services Commission, and Brad Derry, Yamhill County District Attorney. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, and I am the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. I usually follow Mr. Williams in our presentation, so this is a... I really appreciate the opportunity to come before you today and, Senator, to answer the three questions that you posed to the agencies. The first being the state of the administration of justice in Oregon at this time. As I believe many of you are aware, 10 years ago, the governor commissioned a task force on juvenile justice reform, and that task force, after a year of work with many subcommittees and partners and stakeholders across the state, produced a set of recommendations which were codified in Senate Bill 1, which passed in 1995, 10 years ago today, or 10 years ago this year. I will be talking more about the recommendations in that task force and Senate Bill 1 when we do the agency overview and presentation, but that is a backdrop for the remarks I'd like to make today. What is the state of the administration of justice? From a juvenile justice standpoint, it is challenged, and it is challenged due to a series of reductions. It is challenged due to partners and stakeholders and participants in the juvenile justice system having to make some very difficult decisions. Probably the most difficult was to identify who would not be served in the juvenile justice system with reductions that occurred during the previous biennia. But they were not only youth that would not be served, but they were families that would not be served and communities. We also, as I believe was mentioned on Thursday by the superintendent of OSP, we had numbers of staff who were laid off as we closed four of our facilities and ultimately released 250 youth offenders back into the community. This challenge is in an environment where there is an increased expectation for collaboration among partners and to gain efficiencies. And we have found that we have moved from an administrative structure of a more regionally based and community sensitive to a centralized administrative structure with reduced capacity at times to carry out what we would see is a more collaboration at the local level. Interdependence is another word I would like to use in terms of the state of administration of justice. When we spoke before the joint Ways and Means for Public Safety, Human Services, along with Judiciary. We talked about the profile of the youth offenders that we serve, and I think it is absolutely critical that this committee, as you contemplate the budgets for all public safety agencies, understand the interdependence that these young people have on a variety of services, which in fact serve to divert them from further penetration into more restrictive and at times more costly and longer term confinements. The juvenile justice system relies heavily on partners, both in public safety and others. Department of Human Resources is an integral partner for the service delivery that our youth and their families and communities rely on. The Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, each county has a juvenile department, and they serve the needs of youth on probation. Again, when we do the agency presentation, you will see that we manage about 20,000 adjudicated youth offenders in the state of Oregon. About 2,000 of those are served by the Oregon Youth Authority. 18,000 are served by local juvenile departments that are at the county level. Very important partnership there with those folks. Our providers, which are private nonprofits, more traditional providers, and non-traditional providers, the faith community being one of those. The other interdependence is a balance between prevention and early intervention to the other end of the spectrum in juvenile justice, which becomes the youth correctional facilities, which show that continuum and reliance on the different parts of it. We have a system where the demand exceeds the capacity along all points of that continuum, whether it's in the early intervention and prevention end, whether it's at the local juvenile department end, whether it is in ancillary services that are being provided by Department of Human Services to families, or whether it is in the secure facility side, the needs exceed the demand. But there's good news in terms of state of juvenile justice. The Senate Bill 267, Evidence-Based Best Practice, is moving ahead not only with the Oregon Youth Authority, but with our partners and with our contractors. And there is a tremendous spirit out there of being able to move ahead with this and make it make sense in Oregon. And I think people are very excited about that work that's been done. We also have extremely competent and committed staff, both in our field and our facilities and in the support end, and I think that that is one thing that we should be very fortunate of. We have strong leadership at the state, local, and private sector levels. We have a commitment to work together to identify and address the challenges that lie in the juvenile justice system. Juvenile justice in Oregon is seen as a national model. And there are two examples I'd just like to point out. One is the Juvenile Justice Information System. And this, as many of you know, is a data system that was developed partially around the Y2K fix. And it became an opportunity for our local county juvenile department partners to fix their systems, to join together with the state of Oregon in one information system that provides from the time of first referral through commitment to the youth authority and termination, a seamless point to go to in terms of data entry. And it's with that data system that we are able to now look at outcomes, that we're now able to tie the practices of evidence-based programs to youth and to particular contracts, as well as our own programs that we operate. The other is Senate Bill 267. I was just in a training for new state agency heads in juvenile justice put on by the National Institute of Corrections. And these were the two areas where people consistently came up and talked, JGIS and 267. How is it that Oregon was able to enter the evidence-based best practice arena by, in fact, passing a law, tying it to the budget, and getting all partners and stakeholders, not only in juvenile justice, but adult corrections and Department of Human Services, working together to look at these issues. And that's what's happening in Oregon. And I think that as members of the Legislative Assembly, all of you should be very proud of the work that was done on that. We were asked to speak the highest priorities. there is an absolute critical need for mental health services within our population. And when I say within the population, we can go to the 20,000 that have been adjudicated and are either being dealt with by counties, but we narrow it down to 2,000 that are being dealt with by the Oregon Youth Authority. As I pointed out in the other forum, overall 59% are diagnosed with an Access 1 mental illness, and 79% of the young women that we deal with are diagnosed with an Access 1 mental illness. And these are young people that we have in our correction system that have these mental health needs that we are working with both DHS, we are working with DOC and our local partners to try to patchwork together and braid resources to meet these needs. But it is a very difficult and challenging proposition within the context of a public safety agency to have as many young people as we have with mental health issues. Along with the mental health issues, alcohol and drug, methamphetamine, there is a direct and indirect relationship with the population we're serving. There is the increase in property offenses that we are seeing with young people related to methamphetamine, but probably most important is the impact on families, where these young people are coming from, where there is either meth use or manufacture. And this is a noticeable impact that there has been in the juvenile justice system. I would encourage, of our priorities for this committee, I would encourage this committee to visit one of the youth correctional facilities, have the opportunity to talk with youth offenders, have the opportunity to see our programs, and firsthand get some experience with that paradigm. We would also, Senator, welcome the opportunity to hold one of your hearings in one of our facilities, Hillcrest, which is not far from here, 10 minutes, has space that might be conducive to holding a public safety sub-hearing there. Most valuable public safety partners, I don't think I can be repetitive enough to make the point that we are an interdependent and an interconnected system. We do not see the Oregon Youth Authority standing alone as the answer or the end-all for youth that find themselves in contact with law enforcement for behaviors that, in fact, would be crimes if they were adults. We work very closely with our local juvenile department partners at the front end who provide services to lower risk offenders, and their success reduces the need for more costly state services. We partner with the education both in the community and in our facilities. Their success in keeping these young people in school and the services they provide once they are in a correctional facility are of the utmost importance. DHS, as I have mentioned before, crisis mental health, A&D treatment, and the prevention services which they provide to families at an earlier point along the continuum. Our residential providers that we contract with that provide excellent out-of-home care services, both for youth that are on probation and youth that have completed facility programs are now on parole. Department of Corrections, a very close partner. We work with 300 approximately DOC transferred youth that we are housing in our youth correctional facilities on a daily basis, and have close contact with both their intake function, their medical function, just as well as administratively. I think the Youth Authority and DOC have formed a very close partnership. Oregon State Police, they are responsible and extremely cooperative in providing all of our investigations within facilities, and we consider them to be very close partners. Department of Justice, Defense, District Attorneys, all of the traditional public safety agencies are very closely tied to what we do. So I would be happy to answer any questions or answer them along with Max after his presentation.
Members, I would suggest that we hear from Director Williams and then have questions for the panel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jester.
Madam Chair, and I too want to thank the committee for the opportunity to share some thoughts in regards to these three questions that you posed, Madam Chair. The first question you posed is, what is the state of administration of justice from the perspective of your agency or jurisdiction? And I always like to start a conversation about the Department of Corrections by reminding everyone who will listen to me about what our mission is, and it's to promote public safety by holding offenders accountable for their actions and reducing future criminal activity. I really have two parts to the answer of your question, and I'd like, because I think our mission has two parts. I would tell you that I believe that the Department of Corrections does well at operating safe and secure institutions, and we're committed to the fair and humane treatment of inmates that we have in our custody. Our values and our ethics code require it for all employees, and we take seriously our statutory and constitutional obligations. We strive fully to comply with both state and federal laws regarding the treatment of inmates, the delivery of services, while at the same time keeping most Oregon's most dangerous offenders isolated from the public. We strongly react when staff or others associated with our system violate those principles, and we have systems of audits, reviews, investigations, and the like that we consistently rely on to help us maintain that level of administration of justice within your 12 operating prisons currently around the state. The second half of our mission, that part related to reducing future criminal activity, is an area where we are not doing as well as I'd like. Currently, our recidivism numbers are up slightly to approximately 31%, which is a three-year period of time with a new felony conviction for someone who's been released. This is not because of a lack of vision or, frankly, a failure of strategy on the part of the department, but really falls down to a function of two factors. The first is a public policy choice made by the people and the legislature that has required a prioritization of funding to address growing levels of incarceration, and then obviously the second factor is the lack of available resources in relationship to that set of prioritizations. Examples of places where I would tell you that we are not fully achieving our mission are in areas like alcohol and drug treatment, where we have high need and not sufficient access to those services. Mental health population issues, as Mr. Jester had referred to in his system, very similar in our system, with 23% being diagnosable with a mental illness and 14% of our population having a severe or acute mental illness. The challenge we have of transitioning inmates back to community, when 95% of our population ultimately will release back into a community, and the challenges associated with those people transitioning back to community effectively. And at the same time, this community sense of, frankly, not in many cases being willing to receive those people back to the community even after they've paid their, quote, debt to society. Jobs, housing, and ongoing treatment to stabilize their life continue to be a challenge, as are the issues associated with reconnecting these individuals to their family, parenting skills, and the like. So with respect to administration of justice, Madam Chair, I would say that on the one hand, I think we do a good job in managing a solid, fair, and progressive prison system within the state of Oregon. But the issues related to transition and reentry back to community, I think, still challenge us to effectively fulfill that second half of our mission. The second question you posed was, what's the highest priority issue that must be addressed or accomplished by this legislature, this session, in the area of administration of justice? It's hard to answer that question with a single priority, and I think you've seen my colleagues as we have each tried to address this struggle. This is the point that I think has been made over and over again, and I'll try not to belabor it, but this is an integrated system of justice. Each one of us is not a separate, isolated ecosystem. We are altogether a criminal justice ecosystem that relies on one another to effectively manage the justice system. You take something away from one person in the system, and it will ultimately have an impact on someone else within this criminal justice system. With that in mind, I'll share with you what I think are both, in my mind, short-term priorities that this committee ought to consider, and then some longer-term issues, because I think you also have to consider the long-term impact on criminal justice as you consider what you're being asked to address. You've heard it mentioned by others, and I'll mention it as well, methamphetamine. We cannot ignore the costs associated with this drug, the impact of destroying families, children, and burdening our social and law enforcement public safety system. Many of the crimes that we have for individuals coming into our system, while they're not categorized or convicted of a drug crime, clearly have a drug component associated with them as those people enter the system, including many of the violent crimes that come into our system. And there are certainly immediate actions you can intake that will have an impact on this approach, and I know many of them are under consideration, from efforts at prevention, interdiction, limiting access to the various component chemicals, higher levels of law enforcement, and recommended sentencing changes. But a portion of this equation, and I would tell you I believe it is a substantial portion of this equation, in my opinion, is you must also consider the inclusion of adequate resources for treatment of those already addicted. You cannot afford to write this generation of Oregonians off because there are too many of them. And for every dollar in longer sentences, I would encourage this committee to consider investing an equal dollar in treatment and prevention-related activities. Prison population management would be the next thing I would have to tell you from my perspective. I have to bring up as an issue that this committee would have to consider as a priority. As you've heard, the forecast numbers will increase by over 7.2% in the next biennium, our prison population, and virtually nothing short of immediate release will change those figures. Even progressive reforms in sentencing policy won't have an effect on the incoming prison population until 2009, if you were successful in moving those sentencing reforms, or later, depending on the nature of the reform. In order to effectively meet that second half of our mission, to impact the lives effectively of those who have been given to our custody, it requires that there be safe and adequate housing, that those people don't need to be worrying about their safety in order to deliver program. You cannot accomplish the second half of the Department of Corrections mission by dispersing the population through makeshift solutions of temporary jail beds or shipping people out of state or crowding them further into unsafe institutional environments. Finally, I have to come back to the issue of reentry, and I made this comment to a town hall I participated in this weekend. I use the term reentry, and I like to remind people of the comparison of the space shuttle reentering the atmosphere, the most critical point of the mission, where the angle of approach has to be right, the surface of the bottom of the thing has to be right, everything has to be exactly aligned, or the shuttle has a catastrophe. Well, in many respects, it's the same thing we're asking these individuals who are releasing from our prison system to do. They're reentering, and if those things aren't right, if the angle of approach isn't right, if the services aren't there, if that support network on the ground isn't handling things right, if mission control isn't monitoring things appropriately, that person has a considerable less chance of being successful when they reenter the community. Access to jobs, to housing, to ongoing drug and mental health treatment are absolutely critical if we're ever going to get the handle on the issues of people transitioning back into community. And somehow, and I would tell this committee that I don't have the silver bullet answer to this equation, but somehow we also have to change the public's attitude, recognizing that 95% of everyone incarcerated will come back to a community. We have to change the public's attitude about how we receive former felons back into society. There has to be a way to change that perception, and other than talking about it at this point, Madam Chair, I'm not sure I have the answer. Over a three-year period of time, we'll release approximately 4,000 offenders who will return back to communities. We'll release 12,000 over a three-year period of time. 4,000 of those will come back into our system at an average cost of about $58,000 per offender, just within the DOC budget. Over that three-year period of time, it will cost the state in upwards of $200 million to manage that returning prison population. That doesn't include the costs associated with district attorneys for re-prosecution or indigent defense or court time or the jail time or the law enforcement time associated with that work. Or once those people release from prison and get back into the community, the post-prison supervision that goes on at the county level. It would be easy, I think, if you collected all those numbers together to exceed $100,000 or more for every person who returns. But on top of that, that number doesn't include what the cost of that new victim of crime was to their family, to their employer, to their insurance company, and on and on and on. The cost of crime is very, very expensive. The efforts to deal with treatment and prevention and changing people's lives is a bargain by comparison. In a long-term perspective, I'd recommend this committee look at the issue and the ability we have and the capacity we have to make critical public safety decisions long-term for the state of Oregon. For a long time, and as a former chair of the House Judiciary Committee, I can tell you that there were times when we would have loved to know what the right answer to the question was, and we had to basically trust our gut or our instinct. I would tell you that ad hoc criminal justice decisions is an expensive way to run a railroad. And an investment and a strengthening of the capacity of the Criminal Justice Commission and its membership to provide independent and objective and evidence-based data for policymakers is, in my mind, long-term absolutely essential to the well-being of the public safety system in the state of Oregon. Then using that capacity to consider smarter sentencing reforms that will focus our resources where sentences will make the biggest impact on whether the offender will or will not reoffend, while maintaining the essential element of punishment that is constitutionally required in Oregon. In some cases, for some crimes, that might mean lengthening sentences. In other cases, it might mean shortening them. But smart sentencing will absolutely be necessary. If you look at the forecast and the fact that we will add an additional, we'll go from 13,000 to almost 18,000 inmates under the current forecast in the next 10 years, I would suggest to you that the challenges you have today figuring out how you'll fund the DOC budget will only get larger over time. It is a trend that ultimately I would suggest to you cannot be sustained by the state's general fund in its current measure. And the tools you need to figure out how to make that different currently don't exist at the level that they need to exist in state government to provide you that information and that data. And that's why the investment in critical decision-making capacity is one that I would highly recommend to this committee. Finally, the question with respect to partners and partnership. It is an integrated system, and we partner with virtually every one of the people who have and will still testify in front of you in this review. But one of our most important partners, as with Mr. Jester and his relationship with his counties, is our relationship with the counties in providing the community corrections resources. We have 13,000 offenders almost within our system. They supervise over 30,000 offenders who are released on parole and post-prison supervision. That is the on-the-ground place where the nature of reentry and successful transitioning back to communities takes place, and it is a tremendous job. And they are overly burdened in their ability to determine which of those groups of offenders they intend to be able to put resources behind watching. Obviously, we all suggest, and I think you've heard everyone say, that we try to go to the highest risk offenders and put our resources there. But that means as those resources dwindle, fewer and fewer people can be received both services and the necessary supervision. The list goes on with district attorneys, our relationship with the courts, our relationship with the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, the state police, who also provide that independent investigatory and law enforcement component within our system, where they investigate both crimes committed, the violent crimes committed by inmates against inmates, as well as our staff issues within our institution, and we appreciate their relationship with us, and it's an important one. Our relationship with OIA, certainly Mr. Minnis, Director Minnis and DPSST, who train our staff in a much more complex prison environment than existed even 10 years ago. Issues involving mental health and the various management issues, along with the laws that are currently applicable to corrections, makes it a very complicated environment. And we appreciate our relationship with DPSST as we meet those challenges. The Criminal Justice Commission, DHS, employment, housing, mental health services, faith-based and not-for-profit organizations all make up this framework and this palette that we use to try to address the issues that we are facing today. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be pleased to end my remarks and take any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you very much, Director Williams. And let me also thank you publicly and on the record for your participation on Saturday at the town hall, which was sponsored by Representatives March and Dingfelder and myself at Park Rose House High School. Your presentation was excellent, and we very much appreciate your willingness to stay and share your time with those 325 people who came out to hear you, and that you were willing to stay after the time allotted to respond to questions. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure, Madam Chair.
Members, let's take your questions or comments for either Mr. Jester or Mr. Williams. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, you mentioned the needs exceed demand on a number of fronts. It was my impression, and maybe I'm wrong, that that we weren't fully utilizing some of the OIA facilities. And can you explain that to us?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, yes. As part of the response to the passage of Measure 11 and what had been a capped growth in the juvenile justice system, the state built 5 new, smaller, state-of-the-art juvenile corrections facilities. That construction began in 1996, was completed in 97, and the facilities were all occupied by 1998. And as a result of the budget reductions last biennium, we in fact closed 4 of the 5 newer facilities. And 2 of those 4 that were closed have been reopened. One has been transferred to the Oregon National Guard, and one, which is in Albany, remains closed, all closed in terms of the state's use of it. Although Linn and Benton counties collaborate and continue to operate a detention facility within that structure, the reason that we are not using those beds is that they're not funded. It's not that they're not needed, they're not funded. The demand forecast, very similar to the same forecasting model that is used for Department of Corrections, also applies for the youth population, and that forecast shows a 285-bed growth for us that would be put online 1st of July of 05. And that growth is not funded in the governor's recommended budget. Does not mean the need is not there.
Can I follow up?
Certainly.
Did we build those facilities with COPs, the certificates of participation?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, yes, we did.
And are we still funding the debt on those?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, as part of the Oregon Youth Authority budget, we do have a line item for debt service, and we are making payment on those facilities.
Representative Wisnott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick ones, Mr. Jester. Access 1, you mentioned in mental health. The second thing is, I'm sorry, I don't know, what is the age of your inmates in OIA, and do they, when they get to a certain age, do they go over to Mr. Williams' facilities, or do they stay with you? And last question is, both of you have talked about the importance of mental health and reentry. Are there funds in your budget we should look at and highlight when they come to us?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, 3 excellent questions. Let me take the first one. Access 1 diagnosis is a psychiatric diagnosis that is not a behavior disorder, so it actually would fall into a more serious mental health diagnosis than just a behavior. And the age of jurisdiction for the Oregon Youth Authority, the youth must have reached their 12th birthday, and we have the ability to retain jurisdiction up through their 24th year. Upon their 25th birthday, the jurisdiction of the Youth Authority automatically terminates if, in fact, they were committed to our custody as a youth offender. If they are transferred from the Department of Corrections, that's the latest period that we can keep them before they would have to be transferred back to Department of Corrections for further incarceration if they had not completed their minimum sentence.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, the last question you had about watching in our budget for areas involving transition and reentry services, when we present the budget more fully, you'll see the individual, at least for DOC, a divisional breakdown. And in June of this year, of last year, 2004, the Department of Corrections reorganized and created a transitional services division from some of our old program divisions and tried to consolidate all of our transitional services into one division within the department, and that includes our community corrections relationship, and that will be identified as a divisional portion of our budget that you will have a chance to look at the time of the more full budget presentation. I'd like to tell you it's a large percentage of our overall budget. It's a division with big hopes and with a fairly small budget percentage given the nature of all the rest of our operational costs, but it will be highlighted and we'll enjoy filling you in more about it when we present.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin, and then Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Williams and Mr. Jester. I wanted to put a question, almost a statement, in perspective. Often before session, I will get letters from county sheriffs saying that how they do not have the facilities, the staff, et cetera, to deal with the number of incarcerated individuals that they have with significant mental health problems. In my responses to them, I always indicate that neither does the state have the ability to deal with all of the inmates we incarcerate, both juveniles and adults, to deal with all their mental health problems. And I further state that I don't have the ability to deal with all of the problems outside of that system with juvenile and adult mental health and drug and alcohol dependency problems. But I'll put that in light of this budget, in that the governor, at least he made a clear statement in his ballot measure one statement in terms of what his level of funding is for the state school fund. He at least said pretty openly that he has underfunded what he considers the essential level by $316 million. And he said one of the options for addressing that, and he did list some real options, was actually laying off the approximately 880 school counselors in the state, which is about one for every 600 students. Now, how would you set my priorities? At the beginning? At the end? I didn't even mention the victim in this. I didn't even come to the victim, which is another whole scenario.
Madam Chair and Senator Devlin.
Realizing that you were on the bad side of that vote in the last.
I appreciate the question, and I appreciate the challenge. I can't say maybe as much as you because I'm not in your chair today, but I feel like I was there not very long ago and know exactly what you're staring and what you're up against. And the question that you pose is one that doesn't have a good answer, Senator. The reality is that there has to be a balance within that service continuum. We can't ignore the need for prevention at our peril. At the same time, given the large number of people whom we've incarcerated and who have serious mental illness issues, we can't afford to provide them services both within the system and upon their release, and we do so, again, at our peril and with significant long-term impact on the financial resources of the state, not to mention the lives of these individuals and their families and the potential re-victims or new victims of crime that could be created if it goes left unabated. There is no silver bullet answer to your question. Only the good judgment and wisdom that collectively this body will have to apply to this conundrum that we face.
Senator Winters, and then we'll move to the next panel. I'm sorry, did you?
Well, Mr. Jester certainly wants to have a crack at that question. I think that's fair.
Madam Chair, I liked your first instinct to comment on the I appreciate your attempt. Suffice to say, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that I agree with everything that my colleague, Mr. Williams, shared with you. I think it is a challenge, and one of the things that we will be talking about when we present the Oregon Youth Authority budget to this body will be the balance in the continuum. And it is finding where that balance is and keeping that balance funded, that will be very important. And I think that it is a combination of making certain that all points along that continuum have been addressed. Is there enough money to fund all the programs? Clearly there are not.
Thank you. Senator Winters.
Just to go back a little bit, the question was raised about the closed facility. And my question,
Senator Winters, we need to get you on the microphone.
Oh, I thought maybe you could hear me without the microphone. There was the discussion about the closed facilities. And, I'm reminded of this action that says, if you build it, they will come. So my question is, we built it, and where are they?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I think the answer is clear, that they are in our communities, and they are currently being underserved. They are being underserved because the funding is neither in the facility to serve them, nor is the funding in the community to prevent them from needing to further escalate to that point. And that's what the demand forecast, which showed the 285 beds would be needed in this coming biennium to bring the system back into balance, that's how they determined that. There is a like number, 285, currently in our communities that are not receiving service.
We're going to shift to the next panel, but I want to thank both.
Can I get a quick follow-up, Ms. Chair? Just a quick
10-second
follow-up.
10 seconds?
Yes.
I'm starting to count.
They just nod their heads. The difference between these two gentlemen is that largely when someone comes to the door of his facility, he can't refuse them.
Right.
He can't. Largely, unless they are ultimately going to his facility.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, with all due respect, I think your statement is true up to the point that we also do not have the ability to refuse them. What we do is we do have discretion in returning young people back on parole. So we do have discretionary parole authority, so we can release people. And that's a difficult challenge for the youth authority, is determining who is not going to be served, because we need to make that decision when we are over a population.
Madam Chair, when they return, I would like to, for them to give to bring back particularly some recidivism statistics that have a correlation between budget. That would be very helpful as we have these discussions.
Thank you.
Since we're asking for material, can I get numbers on recidivism that are based both on inmates and institutions, what the recidivism rate
recidivism for people first time in a state facility, because they are two different issues.
We'll do our best to comply, Madam Chair.
Thank you again both very much. We appreciate
thank you for having us.
Your patience in coming back for this second day, and we're also very appreciative of the content of the information you've provided. Thank you. Mr. Peter Ozan, Director of the Public Defense Services Commission, and Brad Berry, Yamhill County District Attorney. And let's add Michael Washington, Chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, would you like me to proceed first?
Please.
My name is Peter Ozan. I'm Director of the Office of Public Defense Services. And I'm going to have, as we all are, chances to speak to you, I think, in a couple of weeks about the agency in particular. And though I will certainly try to give you a perspective of our agency, I'm going to take the brief opportunity I have to share with you some perspectives from other walks of life, including as a federal prosecutor and a author of Oregon's Master Plan for Corrections, but also as a private citizen. I want to talk about this public safety or justice system as a system, and I don't mean to point fingers at any particular individual. You've already heard enough and are well aware that these systems are interdependent as agencies were part of them, but they behave in certain ways. When I say they, I mean pretty much the states. I've worked in four states, and these systems tend to behave as organisms or hydraulic systems, and they tend to be treated similarly by citizens and legislators. And the obvious first observation about the system is they tend to be, like many social systems that you're struggling with, they're overworked and underfunded. There's a lot of expectations in public safety. The problem is there more crimes are created and the system tries to absorb it. Either the system has to triage or ignore, under-enforce the law, or we turn into processes like in some states, and fortunately not yet too often in Oregon, where we have rocket dockets, or what I sometimes call open-air markets of plea bargaining, in which first-time offenders and people, youthful offenders who are greeting justice for the first time, see the justice system as overworked and not credible. All of us have great expectations for our public safety system, and I would submit to you, and I think there would be widespread agreement, that the most important thing that we do in justice and public safety is to protect society against violent criminals, apprehend, adjudicate, punish, hopefully deter, and hopefully reform. After that, there are many other things that are asked. I think a theory as a federal prosecutor that I use, broken windows, that we need to attend to quality of life crimes in the community to make them safer, is an added burden. The question I think we all have to ask collectively, and you do in these times of shrinking resources, is to what extent can we pursue those kinds of strategies? To what extent is the public safety system, the social service system of last resort? Certainly we all want to provide alcohol and drug, job training, mental health services. How many of these services ought to be provided in the public safety system as opposed to somewhere else? Finally, I think there are two other points about the system before I get to what I would submit, or I'm presumptuous enough to suggest some priorities for you all and perhaps some other agencies. Public safety systems, in my view, are largely unfocused. Resources are spread an inch deep and a mile wide. We don't really focus on what matters. And the reason I think that is because we have consciously in this country structured the public safety system to divide responsibility and authority. We have three levels of government, federal, state, and local. We have three branches. And then we have numerous public officials who are elected in all these systems. So it's very difficult to coordinate us. There's even a question of whether it's a system at all. And then finally, these systems grow, and they've mostly grown in my lifetime. Now I think we're facing a time where they may shrink. In either event, the process has typically been haphazard. And it's been haphazard, not for any individual's fault, but because so many different governments and elected officials have their hands in this system. It's very difficult, and one of the challenges you face is how do you manage this system with so many players, so many cooks stirring the broth? Here are the three views, and by the way, what I just said I think would reflect the perspective of my agency with regard to trying it doing its job and as an integral component of this system. And one of the reasons I admire Max Williams so much is I tend to agree with him quite often. And I usually agree with him, and I agree with him with what he said today. I wouldn't have said as much that I'm going to say because it's his turf, not mine. But I want to talk a little about downsizing. I want to talk a little about focus, and then I want to talk about one of the suggestions Max had. If this system is upsized, and for example, I wholeheartedly support the notion that we need to address methamphetamine. If it is downside, and many of you have read The Price of Government, and as a citizen, I would expect that our public safety system will face times of downsizing, including my agency. The question is, will you right-size it? Will you size it proportionate to the functions we perform? Because if you don't, the system won't work well. That is, if you cut the forensics lab, my colleagues, the prosecutors, the parole board, the corrections department, or indigent defense, as we found a biennium ago, the system can't function effectively. It needs to be right-sized. It needs to be shrunk proportionately or grown proportionately. If you wage a campaign, which I would support as a citizen, against methamphetamine, then, for example, if you fund prosecution, which I think is very necessary, and then you expect to have those cases adjudicated, you will need to fund indigent defense, or I will need to direct lawyers away from something else to deal with the prosecution of methamphetamine. So if the system grows, it seems to me it needs to be grown proportionately. I was going to mention there's some good examples of focus, and we could say this about methamphetamine enforcement. Where are the points where it makes a difference? Are you going to stop the use and abuse of methamphetamine throughout society? Are you going to work at manufacturers? Are you going to work at home manufacturers or big-time manufacturers? Public safety system tends to cast a net. And sometimes we try to cast it too wide, and sometimes the mesh in the net is too fine, and we wind up filling our nets with minnows, and the fish never really get caught. And I think, again, you have to think about focus. An area of focus that I was going to mention on my own, but now that Max has, is reentry. Oregon, really, and I can say this with confidence because I took Max's predecessor back to Attorney General Janet Reno at a conference once and persuaded her, I think, we certainly contributed, that the country's first priority really had to be reentry. Prisons and jails in this country are releasing 600,000 inmates per year, and Max just gave you the numbers in Oregon. As a federal prosecutor working on gun violence, we saw the violent offenders in the state coming to mostly two zip codes in Portland. You all have felony flats, and you all have analogs to this in your community. The inmates out of the institutions are coming back to your community. They need to be supported. Most importantly, they need to be watched. There has to be coordination between these branches of government. And I really applaud Max and his colleagues about the initiatives in reentry. That is a great example of focus. We can't do everything, but for the 30 years I've been in the state, we haven't done enough about that crack between prisons and the community. Why haven't we? Because we share jurisdictions and no one's really looked at that. Finally, as a person growing up in the 60s, I might say this. I said, feed your head. There's a famous song about that. But I'd say, feed your brain. And Max has already said that. The public safety system is largely, in most states, a headless horseman. There's no head, there's a lot of body, and there's a lot of efforts. There are a lot of leaders, and certainly that's true in this state, but because of the division of authority and responsibility, no one provides objective data, good advice on best practices, tough analysis. I think we're all, I certainly know that everyone else maybe, but me in this room is honest and straightforward in their presentations. I'd like to think I am too. I think you can trust us, but you can't trust us entirely because I live in a bubble. I live in my silo now that I've been here, and my perspective about public safety is my own. And I think you need an Office of Management and Budget for Public Safety. You need an independent, nonpartisan, first-rate research capacity. And as Max has indicated, it resides, in my view, in the Criminal Justice Commission. So in the immediate term, you need to, I think, downsize or upsize and right size. That's the first thing. Secondly, you need to have focus, in my opinion, my humble opinion to you as a private citizen. And third, long term, you need a brain. One you can trust, one that collects data on a national basis, and one that gives you good, rigorous analysis on where to lead this very difficult system to manage. And there are two good models. There are probably more. Texas, ironically, and Washington. Both have systems that are quite like a state office of economic analysis. And they advise the legislature and anyone else about best practices and provide their own research. This is relatively expensive in terms of traditional, what I understand, staffing of the Criminal Justice Commission. You need a couple of PhD-level researchers who can conduct independent research to do this. But by comparison to what you spend on indigent defense, on corrections,
I'll go there.
Because it's not my prosecution. This is a small amount to pay. Thank you for your attention, and I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Certainly, Senator Winters, we are going to try to get through the panel and then take questions, but go ahead.
And it's a question you can think about. You don't have to give me an immediate response. But I'm looking at the U.S. as a whole, and you talked about crime, and you talked about all these various levels of violence and the others. Do we commit more crime in this country than they do in other industrialized worlds?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, actually not. Our crime rate trails Australia, New Zealand. And my last, I did a study recently on this, so I'd have to, I'll check with you and I'll get the specific countries. England, where we though, however, lead the world is in violent crime. In other words, the burglary rates in Australia are quite a bit higher than ours. So we don't have necessarily the highest crime rate, but we have a penchant for violent crime.
And do we have longer sentences than other nations?
Yes, indeed.
So we have the violence and then we keep them longer.
Yes, that's true.
I've just always wondered, because, you know, we're a young country and we're supposed to learn from other countries, and I've had that question in my mind, whether as an industrialized nation, whether we were leading the rest of the world.
Well, we are leading in lengths of sentences, certainly, and as I say, in violent crime, but not in crime in general.
Thank you, Mr. Roseanne. We'll be coming back to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Bradbury, Yamhill County District Attorney. I am immediate past president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and some of my comments, I think, will be more general and others more localized to my community. And it might might be better characterized as some random thoughts, since I think you're finding some common themes among those who are presenting to you. But I might start with the first question put to us, and that is the from the perspective of my agency, from district attorneys and prosecutors, the State of Administration of Justice. And as I reviewed that question and tried to come up with a simple answer, the only term I could come up with was precarious. And I mention that for a couple of reasons. One, I think, as you are well aware, and those who sit both beside me and behind me recognize that this is a system. There is no part of the criminal justice system in this state, especially, that operates in and of itself. The other part that we don't tend to, I think, look at very often is that the public expects the system to work seamlessly. The public expects it to go from the point where law enforcement investigates a crime to someone being arrested and they're prosecuted, to the courts dealing appropriately with that person, to either be dealt with locally or in a state institution, and then ultimately to come out to community corrections and to be reintegrated into the system, into society, to all happen seamlessly. And those of us who are closest to it recognize that that is anything but the fact of the matter. All of those entities, everybody I've talked about, is responsible for their piece, and each, and I'm going to steal a little bit from what Peter talked about, each, I think, finds itself with the inability to completely deal with what is put on its plate. And I'm going to talk in detail, or at least some detail, about district attorneys, but I think we have gotten to a point in the criminal justice system, and I, just putting my own bias on the table, I think there is no higher duty of government than public safety. So I'll put that right out there, right out front. But I think we've gotten to a point where, as we've struggled to make decisions and to make choices on where we should put the dollars, that, as Peter said, we continue to stretch things thinner and thinner. We have a system whereby we are funding many entities of the criminal justice system and asking them to operate on broken down 65 Volkswagen Bugs. I'm not saying that we should fund the system such that everybody's operating in a Cadillac, but they ought to at least have the Chevrolet. They ought to have something that is adequate to get the job done day in and day out, not struggle to figure out how I'm going to cut 10% more from a budget that already will not let me handle what comes through my door day in and day out. Now, as I mentioned, we have many components to the criminal justice system, and of course we look at the officers who are investigating on the street. We look at people in offices like mine to do what we have to do. We expect and count on indigent defense to adequately represent those who are charged with crimes and to ensure that their interests are protected. We expect the courts to be able to hear in a prompt fashion the cases that come before them, and then those that follow us are the other partners in the system, which include community corrections, our local jails, departments of correction, and treatment. And I mention treatment in particular because often I think prosecutors are viewed as myopic to the system and what we do to go out and just get a conviction. I will tell you that's not accurate. As you know, we are legally and ethically bound to seek justice, and that's what my colleagues as prosecutors do day in and day out. But where we become frustrated often are those individuals who I have file after file after file after file with the exact same name on it. And in part that's because as we have funded our agencies and our treatment providers, the Department of Correction and Community Corrections, as we have funded them to operate on the broken Volkswagen, they can't adequately treat. When the Department of Corrections is faced with either turning prisoners loose or cutting treatment, you know as well as I do what they've been forced to do, and that's cut treatment. We spend a lot of time, and I'll talk more in just a moment about alcohol and drug treatment, but as I understand it, there no longer is a sex offender treatment program in the institution. That should not be acceptable. these individuals, as Director Williams said, 95% of them will come back into our community, and unfortunately, most of those who are the most violent offenders and those who are put away for the longest period of time, sex offenders, those who commit sexual offenses against children in particular, are coming out without having received treatment. And I think that's unacceptable, but it's a trade-off. There is no option for the Department of Corrections. I'm not criticizing them for the decisions they have to make. Now, when we talk about funding and the system as a whole, I need to spend a little time talking about district attorneys because that's why I was asked to be here. In the past, the district attorney's offices have been funded through a partnership between the state and counties. And I suggest to you that that partnership no longer exists. I had the opportunity to sit with Senator Gordon and talk a little bit about this just a week or two ago. And I would suggest to you that partnership no longer exists. Previously, the state had paid contribution to district attorney's offices for the purposes of witness fee reimbursement and for the purposes of what we term DDA supplement. In other words, money that came to our offices to aid in the payment of deputy district attorneys. Since the year 2000, through the various special sessions, those funds have been cut almost entirely. The funding of district attorney's offices is solely on the back of counties. Any longer. Even the governor's budget this time, I think, for the biennium has approximately $700,000 in it for deputy DA supplement. That's all. For all 36 counties, for the hundreds of deputy DAs who are prosecuting crimes and protecting victims, attempting to obtain justice, $700,000. And when I come back with the DA's budget, you will see that it funds little more than our insurance and to pay for the state elected officials. And I suggest to you that's not appropriate. When Peter talked about funding all aspects of the system, the district attorneys have been at these desks testifying to you and your colleagues time after time about adequately funding indigent defense. We've been there because we recognize without the defense at the other end of council table, the system cannot function. But the time has come where we need to recognize that on the prosecution end of that, those that the community look at, that they hold up and say, we need you to protect us, we need you to hold people accountable, they also need to have adequate funding. I have deputy DAs in my office. I only have 9 deputies in my office. I'm about a medium size, as the state goes. I have deputy DAs in my office with caseloads of 500 files in a year. And if you were the victim of one of those offenses, you are the ones who are calling me saying, how can my case go to trial and that deputy DA has never talked to me? Because they can't. There is insufficient time in the day. The other part where we talk again about prosecutors being somewhat myopic, creativity in prosecution and to involve ourselves in alternative prosecution programs like drug court, like we have what we call community court services, a mental health court in my county, takes time and resources. What am I supposed to do? Not prosecute certain offenses, shoplifts, thefts, the quality of life offenses, or go into those other programs in an attempt to make better differences and better shots at offenders who come before us? Those are resource-driven in cases where we need to make the choices also. But we do it now in a way where we have to rely on the counties solely, and the counties, as you know, many of you have come from county positions, are hurting for money as well as anyone. Now, in talking a little bit about justice, I just toss this out. Too often when we talk about the criminal justice system, we don't talk about victims. And victims, I suggest to you, are entitled to justice as much as defendants are. They're entitled to know that their cases are reviewed, their cases are studied, and their cases are handled. It isn't a John Doe victim versus the offender. It's the state of Oregon. But we have the responsibility as prosecutors to see that victims do get their share of justice. Now, what should the highest priority, as we look forward, what should the highest priority be? This is a real tough one for me. As Peter mentioned, we deal with violent crimes all the time, and those are cases that are tragic. They're heart-wrenching cases. But I begin to wonder, as I look at the overall picture, whether or not they are any more heart-wrenching than families who are ripped apart by the insidious drug methamphetamine. And you will hear, and I'm confident you have heard, that methamphetamine is driving a huge percentage of all property offenses in this state. Anecdotally, in my county, I would say over 80% of our property crimes are driven by methamphetamine. And I'm not talking just thefts. I'm talking identity theft. I'm talking forgeries. I'm talking cases, you know, if you come steal what used to be the car clout, where they come and steal your stereo to pay for drugs, is now identity theft. Getting my stereo replaced took me half a day to go into the stereo shop and have it fixed. Fixing, when you've had your identity stolen, you can. I talk to victims who after months and months and months and months continue to be harmed by being victimized by identity theft. And that is the crime of choice now for our methamphetamine users. Now, treatment, is it a cure? I mean, I suppose that's almost a goofy question to ask. Treatment can take many forms, I would suggest. It can be early intervention, and from our perspective, that's creative prosecution programs, like drug court, like being involved in drug court. For the chronic offender, especially those who are involved in significant thefts, we need to be sure that counties have adequate jail room for them to exact the punishment that is appropriate, but at the same time, we need to recognize that adequate treatment programs are available. My county had an in-jail drug treatment program that through budget cuts was lost. And that was a loss that we bemoan to this day because it was effective. It gave offenders the opportunity to engage in treatment while they were in jail and to earn their way out earlier. And they went out from inpatient, basically, structured treatment to an intensive outpatient program that tried to keep them straight. However, the other thing that we need to recognize is those who are unwilling to engage into treatment and to be meaningfully involved in treatment. And I'm not talking about those who fall off the wagon and come back at it. I'm talking about those who come back out and begin to steal again, begin to do ID theft, begin to drive under the influence, for example, of methamphetamine. We need to recognize that some of those people, at some point, we have to say, the way we protect our communities is to lock you up, because while you're locked up, you will not be a danger to your family, you will not be a danger to your neighbor, you will not be a danger to those you will victimize. And we need to have sufficient means to do that. Ultimately, for those who will not avail themselves of a treatment, we need to recognize at that point it is a community protection that we need to do. Now, the last question dealt with public safety partners, and I too want to emphasize that there is nobody in the system who is not a partner from the DA's perspective. What I will toss out that I think has not been forgotten, I think the legislature as a whole, this body as a whole, recognized, especially last session, how important the crime lab is. That is a single cog in the wheel that without which many things cannot be done in the prosecution realm. It is a one-stop shop, and on the other side is the only shop out there. The other thing, though, that I must note is that at some point we need to recognize that prosecution needs to be adequately funded, as I mentioned before. I note some 15 years ago, indigent defense funding was the weakest link in the entire system. It was about the time it was absorbed by the state to stabilize funding. It's had its problems since and has had the support. Throughout that time, the Oregon District Attorneys Association has advocated time in and time out for that. But I also believe that the underfunded prosecution will soon become the vulnerable part of the system. If these individuals are committing crime, if they're getting arrested and they're coming into our doors and are being triaged out without being held accountable, we will teach the up-and-coming criminals that they can go to a certain level and commit crimes and do so without any repercussions whatsoever. Be happy to entertain questions.
Mr. Barry, I want to address, first of all, thank you for a very thoughtful and compelling testimony. And I just want to advise you and all of the folks providing testimony today and those in the audience. We have a work group, which is a part of this subcommittee, that I have asked to work on some principles to guide public safety judicial prioritization around the budget. The draft principles that I gave to Senator Winters, who's leading this work group, and Representative Hanna and Representative Hansen, the leading principle says this in its draft form: Oregonians have a right to be safe. Protecting victims and communities is always our first priority. Public safety is essential to our citizens, Public safety includes holding criminals accountable for their actions, preventing crime and reducing recidivism, providing for safe buildings and places of work, preventing fraud and abuse, and maintaining the ability to prepare for and swiftly respond to emergencies to preserve life and property. I'll read one other, and then we'll move on. The second principle says state government should be stable, responsive, and accountable to Oregonians. There is no business as usual with state government. We must be responsible stewards of the public's money while giving them superior customer service. This means we must work in a cooperative and coordinated manner with the private sector and other levels of government. Just to give you a sense of where we are heading in terms of crafting a set of principles that will guide our work. And I hope that's helpful to you.
No, I think that's tremendous. And I'm not for a moment suggesting, Madam Chair, that this group or this body is not looking there. These are tremendously difficult decisions that need to be made. It's just, it's very hard watching all of us struggle, all of us being underfunded to do what we need to do completely. As opposed to some point, I think we need to say, you know, that's a really good idea, but we can't do that today. Today we can't do that.
Right. The conversations will continue. Going to Mr. Washington.
I have a question,
Senator Winters.
So I don't lose it, and he can bring it back.
Thank
because you.
You
mentioned your in-house or your jail drug treatment program. Can you provide with some more detailed information respecting that program and include in that what has happened since you haven't been able to fund it? And I'm looking at whether or not you've gotten individuals back, what's the recidivism, but, you know, something that says when you had it, it was working, and here's how it worked. That would help me a lot. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Washington,
okay.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Washington. I'm chair of the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. And like all of the other people that have come up to testify before me, I think that approaching the answer to your questions in the perspective of the board would start with our mission. And our mission is to work in partnership with the Department of Corrections and local supervisory authorities to protect the public and reduce the risk of repeat criminal behavior through incarceration, community supervision, decisions based on applicable laws, victims' interests, public safety, and the recognized principles of offender behavior change. The partnership that we do with the Department of Corrections and the local supervisory authorities is really important in order for the board to provide its performance and performance duties that it provides to the community. And it has changed over the years, as we all know. Then the sentencing guidelines came into effect in 1989. The board's decisions on release of individuals into community shifted from having those release decisions to supervising those that are released into the community. And in that stead, we need a lot of the help of our partnerships to make sure that we're able to provide that function. But a lot of what the other people that have come up here have said related to the supervision of individuals in the community really relates on the pervasive use of the methamphetamine in the community and the lack of resources to cover the treatment to address that use. The board has, when it releases individuals, it provides them with the conditions that we feel are necessary for them to be safe in the community, and it's really the focus of how we approach that has changed because we no longer have the authority and decision-making ability to decide who goes out into community and who's ready to go out into community. Currently, we have 1,602 individuals that we have jurisdiction over to decide who's released and who remains in the community. And those individuals, as you would imagine, are the most dangerous ones that in the institutions because they are the ones that are holdovers from those that were convicted prior to the change of the boards going to the state going into the sentencing guidelines system. But the board with its three members, its entire duties are surrounded by its statutory functions, and our ability to perform those functions are really dependent on the help that we get from the Department of Corrections and our resources, and we are very efficient in how we run those, how we use those resources, and because we don't have the option of being, extravagant in any individual area, and we have to make very difficult decisions like the other members here and how we perform those functions, and a lot of that has to do with what we decide and how we're going to approach those offenders that come before us and who we decide to keep in the institutions and who we let out, and we have to look at that decision in the context of what's available in the community for those individuals and looking at what the Department of Corrections has to provide for those individuals if we do make the decision to let them out. And it goes on and on down the line as you look at with the other agencies. We have to look at what housing is available, what treatment is available, and what the local supervisory authorities have at, in the area of how they're going to be able to supervise these individuals, because the board can impose all of the conditions that we think are appropriate to keep the community safe. But if we don't have the partnership of the local supervisory authority and community corrections to be able to supervise those individuals by following them and making sure that they comply with the conditions, then that's where the system it fails to be seamless, as the other individuals have brought up. And I think what Mr. Berry mentioned with the sex offenders and what all of the others have mentioned with in the area of methamphetamines, I think that's going to be one of the main priorities that this committee would have to address this session. And I totally agree with what Mr. Williams said, looking at a way of balancing the way we look at the system as a whole. And if we're looking from the protection of the public, which is part of our agency's mission in the public safety arena, we're looking at it from that perspective. If we're looking at the monies that we use to incarcerate individuals, we have to look at the same amount of monies to be used to treat these individuals, because most, especially under the sentencing guidelines, they're all going to be released at some time. And even with those that the board has the jurisdiction over to make the decisions on whether or not they're released, those individuals are coming out at some point. And it may be at a point where we, the board making a decision, don't think that they're ready to go out. But because of resources or other decisions that are going on with our partners in the whole criminal justice system, that decision has to be made to make those release decisions. And that's one of the issues that is really confronting us at this time. One of the things that the board has to do in order for those offenders that we have release decision authority over, we have to order psychological evaluations for them. And depending on the results of those psychological evaluations, that will drive whether or not we can keep those individuals in. It's, from a resource perspective, it's gotten to the point where we have to decide which individuals we're going to require to participate in a psychological evaluation, knowing those that we don't require to participate in those evaluations are going to be released out into the community. So it puts us in the perspective of making those decisions without the help of an evaluation whether or not this person is going to be safe to place in the community. And all of those types of decisions are resource-driven, and like Mr. Ozan said, it's the resources are, spread, a mile wide, just an inch deep, and it affects all of us. And I think that
let me stop you there. Senator Devlin is in line to ask a question, followed by Senator Winters.
Okay.
And if you had more to say, I don't want to cut you off from continuing your thought.
Madam Chair, that's fine. I really didn't have too much further, because it's a lot of what, particularly with Mr. Williams, a lot of what he said, because the board is so closely connected to his agency, I totally agree with. So I could end my statement right now.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Devlin and then Senator Winters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Washington, just for the sake of clarification, I don't know if I'm using current terminology, but your board looks at, I think, both post
post-prison release plans, parole violations, but just a clarification on the 1600, our pre-sentencing guidelines.
And those, yes, those are, Madam Chair and Senator Devlin, those are pre-sentencing guidelines offenders and some post-prison supervision offenders that the board has jurisdiction over, and those would be those sentenced as dangerous offenders and aggravated murderers and some of the murder offenders.
The thing I was trying to clarify for the committee, but I know a goodly portion of those are the pre-sentencing guidelines, which I think sometime in the late 80s they came into effect. So a person actually placed with that long a sentence still in the system was a very serious offender in most cases. Would that be a fair characterization?
Yes,
still in the system?
Yes, Senator Devlin, yes, that would be fair assessment.
When you come before this committee, Madam Chair, the next time, can you give us to some degree what sort of a long-term prognosis is for that population?
So. Okay.
Thank you. And we have one final question from Senator Winters.
And mine is along the same line, and not only the long-term prognosis, but of that 1,600 plus, what percentage of those are minorities? And I'd like to know that. And also, you had mentioned that the psychological exams and that the lack of resources. And I had this discussion with Director Williams because I'm very concerned that those exams can be used in a multiple way. You can use them to keep somebody in, or you can use them to let somebody out. And the direction I'm going is whether or not the individuals who are doing the psychological exams included in that is what component is cultural competency. You know, those of us know that there is things that happen in one's community that if one isn't familiar with what someone's culture is, can misinterpret that to a way, and if their recommendation then is going forward because of some, you know, some little nuances or quirk that I have to say. So I'm very interested in that particular issue, and I've had this conversation with Director Williams. This came up several years ago. And to my knowledge, it was another legislator who was here who raised it. It's been a concern that has been brought forth from inside the institution. And to date, I have not got enough information from either side that says, yes, that is a valid concern, or no, it is not a valid concern. So I'm asking you to bring me as much information as possible with respect to that particular issue. And also this issue of those that are in prior, since 1980, and what percentage of those fall in the minority category. Because as we look at what happens, in our society, I know that if we use some factors, for example, housing and jobs and what have you, and if I look at the high unemployment rate in northeast Portland, those individuals will probably stay in the correctional system infinitum. A lot longer than if you have someplace else to go. So if we use those as benchmarks as to when a person is released, then I've got some, it raises some other concerns in my mind, knowing what resources exist and where people come from. So I put that out there as we grapple with this whole issue of resources. And whether or not we are really utilizing our resources, in a way that is useful and still keeping our community safe. And I just throw that, and anything you can shed a light on this Senator, would greatly appreciate it.
I appreciate Senator Winters bringing those points forward very much, and it ties into what I'm going to say next about one of our other draft principles to guide our public safety judicial prioritization. The third principle, as it's now listed, is framed as access to justice for all. And it says the administration of justice through each point of access and or placement in our public safety and judicial systems must be fair without regard to race, religion, ethnicity, gender, disability, or sexual orientation. That's the language in its present draft form. Again, we appreciate all three of your presentations this afternoon, your thoughtfulness, very compelling, provocative testimony for us to think about, and we will be visiting with each of you at another time. But again, thank you so much for framing, helping us frame this discussion. It will guide our efforts.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bringing up now the Honorable Hardy Myers, Oregon Attorney General, and the Honorable Wallace P. Carson, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court.
Thank you, Chair Gordley, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and appreciate being among those invited to offer a few comments today to the subcommittee. First of all, as to the initial question you posed, what is the state of the administration of justice from the perspective of my agency or jurisdiction? I think I would use two words in response to that, Madam Chair and members. One is threaten, and the other is interconnected, which is, of course, a theme that has run through a great deal of what the subcommittee has heard from other participants in your review. Threatened is a term of many shadings. The aspect of it I want to focus on this afternoon is the very issue of threat to access itself to the system of justice. And I think I mean that access in the sense of the ability to actually invoke the judicial power in order to obtain a just resolution of a particular case, both in terms of individual accountability as well as in terms of, to the extent it involves incarceration, appropriate incarceration, in-custody treatment, post-prison supervision that's appropriate, together with what other forms of continuing treatment and support might be called for in a particular situation. I think it's also worth mentioning, though, very briefly, that access is also a civil administration of justice issue as well as criminal. You're going to be focusing dominantly on the criminal justice system, but the civil administration of justice is of huge importance in our state and society. And we have a tremendous access issue there in terms of the inability of a very large number of Oregonians who do not have the money to pay for lawyers to obtain representation, in being able to present and have a satisfactory resolution of a wide variety of individual situations, landlord-tenant, employment, Social Security, and also in many instances growing out of being victims of crime. There are many victims of crime who need to access the civil justice system for purposes of federal abuse, family abuse prevention orders, other forms of assistance, particularly in the wake of victimization by domestic violence. And there's also the issue of access to the system in the sense of the ability of the judicial department to operate the courts. We've seen in the last 2 to 2.5 years the actual closure of the system to both civil and criminal justice access. And I'm not going to say more about that. I presume the chief will be dealing in part of his remarks with that. But we've seen that most fundamental of access issues apply, the system actually ceasing to operate. But from the criminal justice system side of the issue, Madam Chair, members, I think access is dominantly an issue of prosecutorial and indigent defense resources. I think it's those two particular investments that govern the ability to actually invoke the system in response to individual situations of criminal misconduct. Interconnected. That's a theme I know that has run through all of the presentations that you've received, and I'm not going to dwell to any great extent on it because I think that I'm sure it was probably apparent to the subcommittee even before you began your review that we are dealing here with a system, interconnected, extremely complex, in part because of the reasons that I think Peter Ozan was mentioning. It's highly decentralized, it has many, many components, a great number of independently elected officials who are responsible for portions of it, some state, some local, an extremely complicated system. But that, in turn, segues to my answer to the second question, which is the highest priority issue that must be accomplished by the legislature. I'll be honest with you, I can't answer that in terms of a really discrete issue. You face hundreds of them in the context of your work. I would describe the issue, though, in a more overarching way as how to allocate the total criminal justice resources you have got so as to promote a system of the administration of criminal justice that will achieve the greatest accountability for criminal misconduct and the maximum return in terms of public safety for the resources you have. And the public safety return, I think, is both a function of, in some instances, incapacitating wrongdoers, separating them for some period of time at least from society so that they can no longer do harm for that period. It's a matter of hopefully deterrence. It's hopefully a matter of reformation of the offender through the kinds of in-custody treatment and post-custody treatment and supervision, all of these combining hopefully to provide the largest return in terms of public safety. And it is also very importantly, as has been mentioned at least once or twice, a matter of the appropriate role and service to victims. Because that is a public safety component as well, certainly. The most valuable service that our public safety partners provide to assist the Department of Justice in its missions. First of all, before talking operationally for just a moment, we have a unique relationship in that we are the lawyers for all of the elements of the state elements of the public safety system. And so we have that interconnection. But in terms of our own operating missions on behalf of public safety, I think probably our closest connections arise first with the district attorneys, in the sense that they utilize our district attorney assistance section when they want help with the investigation and prosecution of certain cases. And in turn, they provide an ongoing collaboration with us in carrying out that collaborative mission in those cases. And they are also closely interconnected with us in victims services and assistance through their victim assistance programs in each of their offices and our crime victims assistance section. We have a very close operational relationship with the state police and also with local law enforcement in terms of their assistance in the investigation of many different cases. Invaluable and important, assistance. We, of course, have important interconnections with the federal government in terms of funding and also assistance sometimes in specific cases. And then, apart from governmental partners, I think it's also important to note our partnership with nonprofit entities that are in service to victims of crime all across Oregon. There has been gradually created an important network of nonprofit providers who are assisted by the Department of Justice principally through funding, but also through training. And that's obviously critically important collaboration on behalf of the service to the citizens of Oregon. With that, Madam Chair, members, I'd like to conclude at this point and be happy at whatever time you want to respond to any questions you have.
If Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Wally Carson, the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, but in my role today, I'm the Chief Administrative Head of the Oregon Judicial Department, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here. I'll try to stay on message as we go through the questions. I don't mean to be flip, but the answer to question number one, what is the state of the administration of justice from the perspective of your agency / jurisdiction? My five-word comment would be one step removed from life support. It's serious. That's two more words. The second question, what is the highest priority that must be addressed? That's an easy one. Funding. Where it comes from and how it's spent is much more difficult. And third, what is the most valuable service that your public safety partners provide to assist in your mission and its cooperation? Let me go back to the top. I'm going to use the administration of justice in a broad brush term as the rule of law, because I believe that to be the keystone of our democracy, and without it, we're doomed. And I agree with the Attorney General that in my head I keep not only, and it's because it's part of our budget here, public safety is the focus, but there are civil aspects other than criminal aspects in our budget, as you know well. Also, administration of justice means justice for all. It's been said by almost everybody. We have divided what we do into three components: public safety, child and family, and economic revitalization. We've changed it around a little bit, but that's basically it. And this is from my perspective, or I might say my bias, because I am in the court system. We adopted and then refurbished a future of the Oregon. The future of Oregon, a vision, if you will, Oregon Trail 2020. We had a committee, and then it did it again, revised it, and brought it up, I would say parenthetically, when we did this starting in 92 and completed it, I think, in 95. What we needed to do in the future, we didn't even mention the words internet, and that's so we redid it and brought it up to speed. And this is from that report, the most recent one. In the 21st century, Oregon courts lead the nation, this is our vision, in providing fair, accessible, and timely justice to promote the rule of law, protect individual rights, and resolve conflicts. Two, we respect, reflect, and respond to the diverse people we serve. Three, we earn public trust, build partnerships, and promote safe, caring, and engaged communities. Time is short, so I'm not going to go through in detail, and I'll leave some out and come back to it if there's interest. Courts are indeed interconnected in this system. They're interdependent. I think Mick Gillette mentioned when we were, my colleague, Justice Gillette, when we were before the House Judiciary Committee, that I think it was Jefferson who, commenting on the courts at that time, said, it's their ruling, let them enforce it. And, of course, you can't do that. We don't. The Federalist Papers refer to you as the purse, the executive branch as the sword, and we're merely in between as the adjudicators. I say merely only for point of settlement. Justice in the Balance is a document that we used when we appeared before your joint committees last week, and I commend it to you. And by the way, it has along here the members of the Criminal Justice Advisory Committee to advise me, and Mr. Bradbury's on it, and a number of other people, representatives of the Attorney General's Office, and so on. And this is a piece to talk about public safety from our vantage point. Now, another piece that you have is what purports to be a courthouse. Courts, in my view, are integral in ensuring public safety and protecting vulnerable citizens and sustaining business. I think that if you flip it over on the other side, those of you who have done this before, this is what happens if we approach the terrible deeds, four terrible deeds, justice delayed, backlog of cases out of pace with growth, public service degraded, loss of over 700,000 customer service hours, programs dismantled, drug, family, domestic violence and self-representation assistance services and workforce depleted, loss of trained staff, higher workloads, decreased quality and accountability. I commend that for your review. We have moved out in the community the last decade or two, and it's not your father's court system anymore. We're connected with the community. We depend upon the community to move in areas such as the more innovative and effective and efficient methods, drug courts, family courts, mental health courts, personal representation, facilitation, other programs to serve the needs of our litigants. And we're in trouble, as you've heard from just about everybody else today. Number two, funding. We have a request of the Chief Justice's maintenance budget is a $274 million request, and that is strictly to continue the work we're doing. There are no new programs, there's no new staff, there's no new technology or technology enhancements. In fact, there won't be anything new, just continuing where we have been for the next biennium. The governor has reduced that, and there is a piece in here, this one, that shows the governor's budget drops it down to 249.8, a loss of 24.6 million from what we've maintained we need to have to keep the doors open. And I'm one of those few in Oregon who have the opportunity to shut the doors on justice. I don't claim that proudly. It was an excruciating experience. I got sued in both the district court in federal district court in Eugene and in Portland. We are driven by our constitutionally and statutory mandated work. When we talk about our priorities, they're really your priorities. You set the priorities for us because you pass statutes. And you say this will be a crime or this won't be a crime. We have gone on, and as you see from this document here, we have set our own priorities within the system. So, and we attacked or lost the bottom two, 15 and 16, during our last adventure with budget stretch. But those are internal, how we intend, from the most significant down to the least significant. But we're 24 plus million apart from what we think we need to have. Okay. On the policy issues, what do we stop doing? 8 years ago, I appeared before a committee during the interim. I think it was, no, it was longer than that. 12 years ago, Governor Roberts went through the same, she wanted to downsize government, and so she said, what programs can you cut? Well, we don't have programs as such. We have cases or case categories. And I didn't mean to be rude to the people, it was not the governor, but her, she selected a group. And I said, I don't know, you tell us. What do you want us to stop doing? And we invite you to do that. Either fund us so we can keep the doors open or take things off our plate, and we can tell you that. We have a material to tell you how much you have to take off our plate to get down to, for instance, the 249.8 that the governor suggested will be there. We've been playing catch-up for a long time, not that we're getting good at it or experienced or seasoned, we've been there and would like not to go back there. Also, a small commercial message, I want to acknowledge the work that Robin Lamont has done over the years for us in our, I won't say our good time, but our less bad time than our really bad time. I will say also another 10% reduction would be a disaster, and we'll talk to you about that when we get back. And then cooperation, the third question. One thing we do have, we'd be helpless without the cooperation of our partners in this system, both on the civil side and on the criminal justice side. And I would point out, I deem the legislature and the executive to be equal partners in this. It's not just those of us caught up in this flow, but we are dependent upon you, and we need your activity and help as best we can. We're a reactive branch of government. Everything does tend to come through our doors. We thought that this is probably inappropriate to say, but one way we could save the whole system is shut the courts down. There would be no need for arrests. There would be no need for prisons, because the only way you get to prisons is going through the court system. And then we could all go away. Of course, public safety, you can imagine what would happen in public safety. So that's a facetious comment on my part, but that is, I do it to stress the importance of the court system. We don't control our case flow. We're doing a better job, I think, in moving the cases along. We strive for excellence, accountability, and innovation. We value treating our partners and the public with respect and dignity. And the final document is just another hit on the governor's budget reduction. And with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll shut up.
What's your comments? Senator Winters?
I neither have a question nor would like to have a comment because I'm very honored to have these two gentlemen before us, both of whom have an absolute wealth of history as it relates to our criminal justice system. And I've been sitting here just thinking, how did we get here? I mean, how did we get to this problem that, you know, is before us today when at one point I think in our history we were all feeling very good about where we were and some of the work that was being done and investing, you know, in our criminal justice system. And I think that happens when you're chronologically advantaged and you were here when we looked at not only talking about the element of making certain that individuals get through a system and that, you know, the system functioned well and that those who needed were sent to prison. And yet inside of the institution, we had the ability then to talk about reformation and what we did to prepare individuals for their way out and hopefully if they didn't come back. So the two of you have been a part of those discussions and a part of that building over the years, and I hear your frustration, Chief Justice, because there's when you've helped to build something positive, it kind of hurts to talk about not being able to continue those kinds of things that I know the two of you have been involved with in this state, and I want to thank you for your service.
Thank you very much.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Attorney General, I have you both at the same table and maybe in quasi-agreement on budget issues.
We need them. Personally, another one.
One of the questions I had, and I don't want to put you on the spot, Mr. Chief Justice, you can get to it. I've told the chair I've had a few discussions on the surcharge, and I know that that's going to be an item discussed this budget cycle. It actually has to be discussed because it's one of the few methods we have for bridging a gap. Would that surcharge reduce what you need to get to your to essential level if you had it? I mean, from this, I can't tell specifically if it's an offset against that essential level.
Madam Chair,
I don't want you to say you don't need more money. I just want
No. That's a good question. Two parts to an answer. Number one, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the part of the missing piece between 274 and 249 is rather a little over $6 million, I think, we get out of the surcharge because it is scheduled to sunset at the end of this biennium. 10% continues on and will stay there, so we'll still have some of the dollars, but the bulk of it, the other 20%, a third of it, will end. The deal was, when it came in during last session and it was approved by this body, was that it would be a two-year program to help us over the hurdle of our underfunding, both after five special sessions and also the hit we took when ballot measure 30 went down. I think I'm correct in saying, yes, the disparity is the loss of the $6 million.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chief Justice, in discussions with a few groups that might have to pay those fees, I think although they had hoped, and they may making no commitment, although they had hoped that it would be only 2 years, they know that you're still in trouble. So I think those... Madam Chair, I think we'll have to have those discussions before the end of this session.
I'd like to go back, take you back to Mr. Ozan's testimony and his comment that the public safety system is a headless horseman. He went on to talk about the need for an Office of Management and Budget for our public safety system, and his suggestion was an enhanced role for the Criminal Justice Commission. Reflecting on his testimony and commentary, do either of you have a comment about what he said?
Chair Gordley, subcommittee members. First is to the comment about the headlessness of the system. As I mentioned in my own comments, it's a very decentralized and complex system, and I'm not sure how much can really be done about that, inasmuch as the current arrangement with respect to allocations of responsibilities, some may have footing in the Constitution, others statutory. It's possible you could make some changes that weld greater, more centralized control, though I think the politics around that could be extremely complicated. But that issue aside from the structural issue, I certainly agree that there is a need for a stronger, multidisciplinary planning and evaluation component within the system that we have now. And I think the Criminal Justice Commission could well be a very logical place in which to try to define and place those enhanced responsibilities. The original Criminal Justice Council, predecessor of the current commission, which I chaired for a period of 5 years, had, I think, closer to what kind of role we are now discussing by way of its statutory mandates than the current commission does. At least that's my recollection. And I do think that there, and so I think that the commission could well be the place at which the legislature could look for an enhanced role in planning, in recommended resource allocation, in evaluation of program performance, missions of that kind.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, with great respect for Peter, because he's the executive director of another group upon which I sit, it's called the, and I will not use its initials, it's the Public Defense and Services.
You don't want to contribute?
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. Undoubtedly, over time, I shall, but it will not be intentional. But Peter has really brought new life and direction to the Public Defense Services Commission, and I commend him for that. What struck me was I would have characterized it as hydra-headed, not no-headed. The same problem, however, because the parts are going different directions, but it's not that we don't have a head. The Constitution gives us at least three heads, the legislature and the judiciary and the executive. So I think the problem is maybe too many heads and not the lack of a head. If what he's saying is a central head, I mean one person that controls all the brains, that ain't going to happen until you redo the Constitution, in my view. And I thought, Peter, forgive me, but I thought it was interesting to create another level of bureaucracy to solve the problems of multiple bureaucracies. And well, I'm slandering everybody.
You have 7 minutes to keep going.
No, they're probably going to jerk me back right now.
So many targets, so little time.
That's right. Well said, well said. My thought was that one of the criticisms, the legislature, if I recall, after Hardy left, the legislature did end the council, as I recall it, after had put together all the sentencing guidelines and done the heavy lifting in that area. For some reason, I was never really sure, but they terminated and came back with a much redone commission. I'd like to look and see why they felt necessary. Was it just simply dollars, or was it had too many PhDs, or what it was? So it's worth following to see whether there's some real benefit there. But I'm first time I heard was this afternoon, and I'm not on board, as they say.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chief Justice, Mr. Attorney General, I'm going to probably give you another avenue to take hot shots at Mr. Ozan. Not that I don't believe, too, I appreciated his comments, but I think one of the parties that was left out in those comments, was the fact, if I take an example, well, the legislature, I do think, reacted to public opinion, reacted to public sentiment in putting in sentencing guidelines. I don't think the public really realized how much the legislature had done at that point, and you ended up with Measure 11. And obviously, the other player in this is the public and the initiative system. And regardless of what you have in terms of best practices, you will still have that initiative system. And I can very easily see that if this legislature doesn't do something to address methamphetamines, the public may do that. But trying to get a reasoned approach to that is going to be a difficult issue. The issue I see, though, is that, to be fair about this, if you go pre-sentencing guidelines, the state had become literally not very responsive to public sentiment about treating dangerous offenders more seriously. I mean, we had not built an additional facility. We built one of our, we didn't really build a facility. We converted a mental health facility in Pendleton in the late 1980s. But the last major facility before that, I know there are little bits here and there, was OSCI in 1959. We actually... where there was a real question there about what real sanctions we had for people in terms of parole violations, if we had any space for them. And the public reacted, and maybe they didn't react entirely logical, but as long as the public has that mechanism, I think we will always deal with the issue of being, maybe we'll have four bodies. We have the executive, the judiciary, the legislative, and the referendum, or the initiative process.
Since 1906, that's what the Constitution said.
Yeah.
Yes. Excuse me. I didn't mean to blurt out.
Oh, you're fine.
But you've always had it.
Yeah. I know.
Correct.
And I did like Mr. Ozan's comments, Madam Chair.
Are there other comments or observations? Representative Wisnett.
Yeah, I would like to hear more about the Texas and the Washington model that he also referenced, if we could have that available to the committee.
Very good. We'll work to make sure we get that information. Well, it's just been a pleasure to have both of you here. We thank you very much for your thoughtful comments, and I join Senator Winters and the entire committee in thanking you for the quality of your service and leadership to all of Oregon. Thank you very much for
thank
being
you.
Here. And members, before we adjourn, this is for the good of the order. Senator Winters and I would like to introduce you to Ms. P.S. Piggy, P.S. standing for Public Safety.
You already do it.
Standing for Public Safety. P.S. Piggy will be with us at every meeting, and Senator Winters has agreed to be the person who makes sure that P.S. Piggy leaves every meeting with a contributions. So with that said, unless there's anything else for the good of the order, Doug.
Just a reminder to subcommittee members, and bring your notebooks for Department of Justice tomorrow. Some of you have them here today. Bring them tomorrow, and we will start on that budget right away and schedule it for the entire week. And again, remind folks of next Tuesday. The hearing will be up in Wilsonville, and I'll talk to you later in the week about arrangements if you need it, if we need them to get up there and get back.
And, Mr. Jester, we did hear your suggestions about a hearing or hearings at one of the OYA facilities, Oregon Youth Authority facility. And we will take that under consideration. We will most certainly do that. I just want to say to all of you who have participated over the last two meetings, the presentations have been excellent. very helpful to our understanding, our fuller understanding of the issues that we need to understand to make good public policy choices. I want you to know that we will be sharing the tapes of the meetings, the videotapes, with the Administration of Justice Program at Portland State University, so that those students will have a better sense of what is the state of administration of justice in Oregon 2005. And we thank you for helping us define that. And we're adjourned.